Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome our guest co-host, Dr. Steve Hooper.
Great to be here. Thank you, Adam.
Well, we've got a really interesting show today. We're going to talk with Maya Dusenberry, who's the author of a new book called Doing Harm, about how perhaps medicine and science leave women dismissed, misdiagnosed, and too often sick, something that I'm looking forward to hearing.
Her take on that is going to be especially important given that she is a woman that we understand has had some healthcare issues herself. And quite frankly, it may be an underlooked area in medicine, and we need to be mindful.
Well, first, though, we're going to talk about some research that matters that hopefully our listeners will find valuable. And our very first one is about a study out of Johns Hopkins that was published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine recently about stigmatizing language in medical records. What are they even talking about, Steve?
I think this is important, and it probably came in many respects from the documentary Seinfeld, where they had the medical chart being flagged because of a different difficult patient, and that was the shtick in the show. But this is very serious in that, in fact, it's not just sort of having implicit bias within the chart notes that residents and fellows may leave, but also how it may impact their health care. And at the end of the day, that's very, very important.
Yeah. For this research, they had over 400 medical students and residents, and they were given two different vignettes, samples of a hypothetical patient, a 28-year-old man with sickle cell disease and chronic hip pain. And then they looked at, depending on what medical information they were given them, if it was a neutral language to describe it, so a patient coming in with chronic hip pain or a patient with hip pain, you know, that maybe you don't say chronic or right up front there with the past medical history of pain in the hip. And then, you know, how that affects how people think about the patient. And clearly it makes a difference, particularly for the residents. The further they kind of get along in their medical training, if you use what I would say pejorative language, and I've known this for a long time, you read about a 63-year-old patient who looks much older than their stated age. Why would you put that in the medical record? But some doctors do, and that would influence if you were then coming to see that patient. That's the very first thing you read.
Absolutely. And I think the title of this article starts out with words matter, and we learned that in kindergarten. Words matter. And I think that writing them even at this level in a medical chart indeed can influence how care occurs.
You know, I've seen it in different ways too. Sometimes, I mean, and I wonder if it's okay to write something nice in there, like longtime, really pleasant patient of mine, you know, or is that also biased in a way? And what has a doctor move beyond what they would just normally write, which would be the facts of something, to an opinion about something? I've also seen it in patients who come in are homeless, and I see something in the note that says a patient who regularly is malodorous, you know, a really bad odor when they come in. And they does have a bad odor, but why one puts that in the record? I don't know. I like this article. It really gets me thinking.
I like it a lot as well. And it also leads to how we train our physicians of the future and providers of the future to document what they see in an objective fashion.
Yeah. Leave the attitudes outside, I think, the medical record in that respect.
You don't want to flag it.
Speaking of flagging, this next research is one that I think should be flagged. I think it applies to so many patients. And that is if you have had a condition called atrial fibrillation, which is really quite common, and you may have a procedure that kind of makes the atrial fibrillation go away, but you still may be at risk for strokes because that atrial fibrillation may come back silently, or we don't really know, but we don't see it. But your stroke risk could still be the same, because in the past, we said you no longer had to be on aspirin or an anticoagulant if the atrial fibrillation went away. This is maybe that's wrong advice.
Yes, I think I really like this article as well because it really speaks to the strength of medical surveillance in terms of tracking your patients over time, even from a well health perspective. And I think, you know, health, as we know, is probably on a continuum. And the fact of the matter is just because symptoms go away doesn't mean the risk for an aberrant event goes away.
And I've had a patient, unfortunately, in the past who atrial fibrillation did go away. They're treated successfully. And at some point in time, cardiologists said they didn't need to be on an anticoagulation when then they did have a stroke. That was the best knowledge at that time. This suggests, though, that knowledge continues to evolve. Now, there are risks of staying on a blood thinner for life, too. But this suggests now you should really have a much more detailed conversation with your cardiologist, with your family doctor, your internist, about this question because there's new data.
Exactly. And I think it also speaks to this issue, as I've mentioned a few moments ago, of continuing to see your patients. They may be at longer intervals, but in some many, many instances, they should not fall off the radar screen.
Well, one thing that seems to have fallen off the radar screen is the next research that matters, and that's about women's representation in clinical trials. And I know with our guest today, Maya Dusenberry, in a little bit, where women are getting dismissed more often, or in this particular case, not even enrolled often enough in research. This is a big issue. And I know that your faculty does research and has to think about this.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, there is NIH policy now that drives representation of males and females, as well as different minorities in research studies. And it really, really is important with respect to this article in terms of cardiac care.
And this was in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, and they were looking at kind of marketing approval of drugs that the Food and Drug Administration was looking at on cardiovascular trials between 2005 and 2015. And the range of women that were in these studies was 22 to 81%. So in some of the trials, certainly women were well represented, so you could say that the results would apply to women and men equally, but in other ones, they weren't, and you don't really know to what extent this research would really apply to women or maybe have side effects for women that would be different than for men because we know the biology is not the same.
Exactly. The generalization here is a great risk when the population of interest is not included in the study. And I think that that is a challenge for researchers working in not just this area, but any healthcare arena.
Yeah, they said that perhaps fewer women were enrolling some studies because they weren't being invited to participate as often as men. I often thought, well, maybe some of the women that are being invited to participate also have childbearing duties more than the men and have other things that are going on that make them maybe more difficult. So it may be other sorts of biases that we need to be willing to pay a little bit more or provide childcare or other things that would allow women who have those sorts of responsibilities to be able to participate if they want it.
Very thoughtful, actually, in terms of thinking about the research. And I'm just not sure all the studies have gotten to that level of thoughtfulness.
Well, we're going to talk about our last research that matters. And this is having a thoughtful other in the relationship, whether it's a spouse or girlfriend, boyfriend, someone that you're with and who is perhaps more likely to notice a significant skin lesion that's abnormal. I don't know how often in any relationship you've been in where someone says, that doesn't look good, and they're looking at something on your back, right?
Right. And I think that this study was fascinating to me simply because it spoke to the possibilities and the opportunities that partners and couples who are together get to see each other more often in those unexposed situations.
Yeah, this was 52,000 adults who had early stage melanoma from 2010 to 2014, including 36,000 married patients, 7,500 never married, 3,600 who were divorced, and 4,500 who were widowed. That gets a lot of the combinations, I think.
Yeah.
And compared to those who were married, widows were 70% more likely to have early stage melanoma, and divorced people were 38% more likely to get it, and never married 32%. And the lowest likelihood were the folks who had a partner who was able to see, and these partners were able to actually diagnose them more often in earlier stages. Now, this isn't cause and effect, but boy, it does suggest there's a real role for people who are close to you who are willing to kind of take a look at your skin, or when they see something, say something.
Yes. I think see something, say something is really the key operative here. I also think, Adam, that this drives how practitioners should also be sensitive to who's in the home, who are you with, do you have a partner that you're close with, whether married or not. And the fact is that it may help structure the questions or the kinds of questions that a practitioner may ask a person who's coming in for their health care.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be asking questions with Maya Dusenberry, author of a new book, Doing Harm, about how healthcare can fail women. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Steve Hooper. Today on Conversation, Steve, we're talking with Maya Dusenberry, author of a new book called Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick, about healthcare really can ultimately fail women. Welcome to Your Health, Maya.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's great to have you on the show. And before we kind of dive into so many things that we're both interested in, Steve and I are like biting at the chops to get the first questions in. But tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in journalism and healthcare?
Well, I've been a feminist writer and journalist for about 10 years, since college, really, and have a background in reproductive health advocacy, so I was always really writing a lot about that and kind of thinking about women's health through that lens. And then about 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and that was what kind of started me down this path of thinking kind of more broadly and holistically about how gender bias might be playing out in medicine. Before that, you know, I sort of, as a healthy person, had interacted with the medical system mostly for just routine reproductive health care and really hadn't given too much thought to how well-equipped medicine was to care for me if I actually became sick.
Yeah, that having a disease gives you, unfortunately, unique insights.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm curious, as you, in the title of your book, you know, the second part of it, the truth about how bad medicine and lazy science leave women dismissed. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of your thinking on the bad medicine and particularly the lazy science part?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of long and wordy subtitle there, but I do think sort of captures at least some of what I was hoping to get across in the book, which is that I really think that there are two big issues that are sort of affecting the quality of care that women receive, and one is just this lack of knowledge about women's health and their symptoms that's sort of the result of many decades of leaving women out of a lot of clinical research and kind of prioritizing research on conditions that affect men and really neglecting a lot of conditions that disproportionately affect women. And the sort of lazy science part alludes to the fact that I think to some extent, you know, that was definitely not, you know, malicious, but just a sort of lazy mistake in that it was easier to kind of just include men in clinical studies and just lack of awareness about the fact that there might be these sex and gender differences that might actually matter and we should probably explore them. And, you know, the bad medicine part, I think the more precise word would be biased. And I think that, you know, it's, again, not about a sort of malicious desire to not treat women well, but just that a lot of our knowledge has been skewed to knowing more about male biology. And we all have these unconscious biases and gender stereotypes that play out in a variety of realms and make their way into the exam room as well.
So the move from the knowledge to the trust. I imagine being a male provider or female provider, you might still have problems trusting, or does it matter about the gender of the clinician as they're approaching a female patient?
Yeah, I really believe that it goes way beyond the gender of the healthcare provider. And I didn't find too much kind of systematic research looking at this, but I think my personal opinion, just based on what I diagnose as the problem, which, as you said, is this knowledge gap and this trust gap, you know, really suggests that this is not about an individual problem at all. It's about these systemic biases and what is just known in biomedical research, and these unconscious biases that, yes, absolutely affect all of us, regardless of our own gender. I think they do come into play.
Maya, I really appreciate you tackling this question, because I think we all know that the data here are meager in many instances. But I am curious, as we begin to think about talking about your book here in a minute, what research did you do to sort of, from your public health background, did you interview folks? Did you pull articles? Was it anecdotal sort of conversations with female patients and providers? Can you tell us a little more about sort of how you came to some of your conclusions?
Yeah, I kind of drew from a lot of different sources. So I did interview a lot of experts from within medicine who have been working on a lot of these issues for a long time, dove into a lot of the research that does exist on you know, things like diagnostic errors and gender disparities in treatments. And I did interview a lot of women. I sort of solicited stories via a Google Doc that I just put up on the website that I am an editor at, and sort of spread through my personal networks, asking for just kind of experiences that seem to be related to potentially gender bias, where you were feeling like your symptoms were not being taken seriously or dismissed in ways that you didn't think would be the case for men, and got, you know, almost, I think, 200 stories through that, and sort of followed up with dozens to get the kind of longer version of the story. And a lot of the research also was kind of diving into the medical history in a lot of specific instances of female predominant conditions like endometriosis or vulvodynia or fibromyalgia, and sort of tracing the history to show how our understanding of them has evolved, and, you know, arguing that sexist stereotypes have played a big role in sort of holding us back from knowing a lot about these female predominant conditions.
So let me ask you a quick question here. If we were to look at two conditions, conditions of the breast and predominantly conditions of the uterus, like endometriosis or fibrocystic breast disease, you know, painful breasts, pelvic pain, things that would be unique to women, would those, or almost, would those conditions be treated differently for women than, let's say, a condition of the penis or other aspects that'd be unique to men? If a patient came in historically, how does that play out? Well, give us an example of the type of work that you've come across.
Yeah, I think it's even bigger than comparing, you know, conditions that affect the reproductive organs. You know, one of the things I came across was this idea of bikini medicine, right? So, like, to the extent that medicine has sort of paid attention to the fact that there might be sort of unique needs that women had, it's had this bikini medicine view where the breast and reproductive tract is considered sort of women's health and in that purview. And one of the problems with that is that it really sort of leads us to overlook the fact that there are also conditions that disproportionately affect women, for example, autoimmune diseases, which is what I have, rheumatoid arthritis is, that also disproportionately affect women and have been sort of understudied, and doctors often don't get great training on diagnosing them. And then there are conditions like heart disease that, of course, affect both men and women, and yet have been sort of stereotyped as a male disease and have been mostly studied in men, so that our understanding of the disease is kind of based on this male model. And so in those kind of cases, women's symptoms are often misdiagnosed and not recognized just because they kind of are less likely to meet that textbook model that we have based on male research.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating and extremely important, and we need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Maya Dusenberry, author of the new book, Doing Harm. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you, Maya.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we're talking with Maya Dusenberry, author of the new book, Doing Harm. And Maya, before the break, we were talking a little bit about sort of the inspiration for the book and sort of the background research you did to back up many of the statements in your book. And I'm curious, going forward, as we move into the context of your book, what examples can you share with us with respect to either how things have gone awry and how practices need to change to make it better for women's health?
Sure. Well, I think my sort of first inspiration, as I mentioned, was developing rheumatoid arthritis myself. And I actually had a pretty easy time getting diagnosed, in part because I had a very textbook case. But I started learning a lot about autoimmune diseases, and one of the things I came across was that the statistics that show that so many autoimmune patients face these really long diagnostic delays, often going years and seeing multiple healthcare providers. And in one survey, about half of them said that they had been sort of dismissed as chronic complainers during that time. And I really sort of started to think that the fact that, you know, 75% of autoimmune patients are women might have something to do with that. And that sort of started opening my eyes up to all of these stories of women in my own peer networks and being shared online and internet forums of really very similar tales of feeling like their symptoms were either minimized or disbelieved entirely, you know, accused of being attention seeking or seeking painkillers. And really feel like those stories are very much more widespread than we really recognize, because one of the things that was surprising was to realize that a lot of women who have those experiences tend to kind of keep them to themselves and either sort of internalize that dismissal or assume that it was just, you know, bad luck and it was just an individual problem. And so I think a lot of women are having these experiences and thinking, oh, it was just me, and not necessarily realizing how common that experience is.
Let me ask you a question. As a practicing family doctor, I see difficult, hard things for me as a provider and women many times every day, for which it's, I imagine, easy to, as a patient, to see things that come in that could be dismissed, that could be misdiagnosed. And I always worry about that as a provider. What kind of advice do you have that you've learned that would be important to share maybe with family members of those or providers of those caring for such women?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think one of the things that was really striking to me learning about this stuff as a outsider to the profession was to realize that there's so little feedback given to doctors about their diagnostic errors. And, you know, I was really struck by this sort of emerging research over the last 10 years about diagnostic errors and the people who are kind of raising the alarm that this has been a sort of blind spot and it's not something we've been tracking systematically. And so doctors often kind of have a overconfidence that is not at all due to, you know, personal hubris, but is just about that lack of feedback where they assume that they made the right diagnosis unless they hear otherwise, and they often don't hear otherwise unless the patient comes back and says, you know, you were wrong. And so that was really striking to me, to see how this problem can be really self-perpetuating if the doctor dismisses a woman, and then she goes to another doctor and then another, and finally, four doctors later, she gets a diagnosis, but those first three doctors that she saw never actually learned that she wasn't just this stressed out woman that they saw her as. I hope that one of the things the book can do is kind of help healthcare providers see that this might be a problem that is off their radar in their own personal practices, and to really sort of recognize how much power they have. I assume that a lot of doctors maybe don't recognize how invalidating it can be to be a patient and be told, you know, nothing's wrong with you or your symptoms are all in your head. And so I hope that it will spark empathy among doctors and, as you said, family members and other people who have a hard time sort of trusting women when they say, you know, I'm in pain and these are my symptoms, and even when they aren't easy to diagnose or to explain.
You know, I think, again, as I mentioned earlier, I think you're really tackling a real important area in healthcare. And there is a thrust in the healthcare world for women's health. And I'm hoping that at least in that sector of the medical field that they're picking up some of this and perhaps even maybe read your book in terms of getting some ideas. I had one other question, if I may. We're talking about women, and did you in your research have any experiences or examples that crossed over into not just females, but their socioeconomic status or their race or ethnicity that maybe also may be contributing to sort of the oversights in medical care for females?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very clear that there are other biases at play that really add to the problem for a lot of women who are impacted by racial bias or classism. Weight bias was a one that I found very striking, you know, the problems that overweight patients face getting care, not having all of their symptoms just dismissed on their weight. But yeah, I think that there was a lot of really compelling and disturbing evidence and anecdotal reports that showed that Black women in particular were, you know, very much impacted by the stereotype that they were drug seekers whenever they were reporting any sort of pain, and even at sometimes having trouble even kind of getting past the ER gatekeepers to be admitted because that sort of stereotype was so prevalent and so automatic. So I think that all of these things, yes, absolutely contribute and make matters even worse for a lot of women. And the kind of financial barriers, I think, are really important to realize when it comes to sort of that struggle to get diagnosed. You know, I think for a lot of conditions that require going to multiple doctors to get an accurate diagnosis, for a lot of women who just don't have, you know, the insurance or the sick days to take to do that, it means that they just go kind of undiagnosed and untreated for a lot of these conditions.
You know, we're going to need to wrap up in a second, but, you know, I'm already seeing your second book out there. 5 years from now, well, there may be many in between there, but I would hope instead of it's doing harm, it's doing good. And to get from the place of doing harm, and I'm thinking about something as simple but as really grotesque as one of the deans in one of the medical schools up north who was, you know, really sexually either abusing or favors for to have women medical students get in or stay in medical school, that abuse, that harm that's so right in front of you, but yet the harm of the unconscious that doesn't enable people to succeed. And so I just – what will it take, do you think, in closing, your final words to get us from where we're at now to where you want to see us be as a journalist, as a patient, and as an emerging expert really in this field?
Well, I think there are so many kind of big picture things to solve. I think it's so important to get the knowledge that we do have about sex and gender differences that has emerged over the last 25 years to get that really fully integrated into medical education and cut down on that lag time. To the extent that the knowledge gap is kind of this lingering thing that just hasn't been closed because we haven't kind of put a lot of effort behind changing medical school curricula that quickly. I think that needs to happen. I think that we need doctors to get that education on implicit bias in medical school, to set up systems to get feedback in place on diagnostic errors so that people can learn from their mistakes. But I really think that the most basic thing does come down to just listening to women and believing them and sort of starting from that default place of trust. And I think that doing that can really kind of take us where we need to go, because that will kind of show us where those gaps in knowledge are and lead us to close them more quickly.
Well, we want to thank you for helping us listen, for helping our listeners listen better. We've been talking with Maya Dusenberry, author of the new book, Doing Harm. Thank you so much for being a guest today on Your Health.
Thank you, Maya.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad you're tackling these issues.
We appreciate it, and we hope we'll be back on the show with more things as you write them, please.
Yeah, doing good.
We're going to take a short break, but then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Dr. Steve Hooper will be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Steve and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today.
My wife and I are expecting our first child this year, and I'm excited but also a little overwhelmed. What are the top three pieces of advice that you would give to a father-to-be who's hoping to raise a happy and healthy child?
Well, I have three children. Do you have children?
I have two.
Two. So we have five pieces of advice. My first one is pray. No, it's not. I say a little facetiously because mine are all grown now. But I think praying for a healthy child, praying for the peace of mind of a child and just recognizing the holiness of that responsibility and this meditative place and space to be able to be supportive and giving and loving and the wisdom to make choices and decisions when it's not so easy. So it is prayer, but in a different way. What would be?
I have a few others. I would agree with Adam wholeheartedly, but I think to the best of your ability, relax and enjoy the moment, because it really is a moment. And pretty soon you will be where Adam and I are, where we have older children and young adults, and you'll say, where did that time go? So please try to stay in the moment. I also would suggest don't go through blindly. If there are books around on development, if there are books around on parenting, please at least take a peek at them in your busy time.
And I would even amplify that. If something doesn't seem right, it probably isn't. And to trust your instincts as parents that if something doesn't seem quite right, investigate further. Go ask your doctor. Go ask your therapist, whoever it might be, to say, I don't think things are right. I'd like to figure it out.
The other thing I would add to that is be supportive. Be supportive of your wife, your partner, and by all means, love on that little one because, again, the time will go by very quickly.
And tap yourself on the shoulder and tell yourself you're doing a good job.
You're a good daddy.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My mother is a first-generation immigrant whose English isn't strong. She's seeing a new doctor this month, and I'd like to help facilitate communication in any way I can. What do you recommend?
Well, first off, thank you for being willing to help your loved one facilitate health care. And whereas you sound like you may be able to speak in both languages and facilitate that conversation, I would encourage you to look into the resources and to the practice to see whether they can actually get an official interpreter on the line, because you want to be a supportive family member, not necessarily the interpreter.
I would agree wholeheartedly, and most hospitals around the country now have access to interpreters in a variety of languages, and please ask. Do not hesitate on that one.
You may be in some circumstances where in a smaller practice or in a rural community that maybe doesn't have those resources, and my advice at that point in time is make sure that you are communicating what your role is in that circumstance. So if you're being an interpreter, that you are just saying what the doctor's saying – write to your loved one, and then you're saying back what the loved one's saying to the doctor, because nothing drives a doctor a little more crazy when they ask a question that might be a short answer and there's like a 2 to 3 minute conversation, and then someone turns to the doctor and says, yes. We know there's a lot more that was going on behind that conversation. And then stepping out of that role when maybe it's uncomfortable to have that question or to clarify, because it's not an easy role. But good luck, and make sure you get what you need.
If I may just add one other thing. I think that in this sort of day of healthcare, hospitals are connected. So even if you're in a rural area, asking if that language is available, there may be resources that come from another setting to facilitate the care for your loved ones. So I think that make sure you ask the question before you step into that role, only because I think it makes it a little easier for you to be the supportive child or whatever role you're serving.
Good point. Laura, what's the very next house call?
I wanted to check in with you about how I might get an appointment with a podiatrist. I've developed plantar fasciitis, and I'd like to have a podiatrist look at it, but I'm curious what the protocol is. Do you think I need to see my primary care physician first?
You see plantar fasciitis. They come through. This is a common condition for which different providers probably have different things to add. And what's the advice about when someone may be seeing or wanting to see a specialist, in this case, a podiatrist, for which the patient may well benefit? In many cases, probably would.
You know, in our area, I mean, physical therapy and allied health area, we actually will take referrals from primary care providers. And sometimes those referrals also come from podiatrists, because plantar fasciitis can be treated pretty effectively by a physical therapist.
And then other times, it may be that you've heard of a really good podiatrist who knows how to do the right treatments there, hopefully not surgery to start with. Mm. The simple answer is, it really depends on what your insurance would say. Most insurance companies probably allow you to see a podiatrist. They may require a referral. Not all primary care doctors will actually have a relationship with a podiatrist, just like they may not have a relationship with a chiropractor. So they may or may not be able to. So what I really say is, find out who you may want to see. Do your homework. Ask your provider to do their homework. And then the two of you get together. And hopefully between that, you'll figure out, should you go to the podiatrist? Maybe you want to see the physical therapist, or maybe your primary care doctor can also help you.
I always like the strategy of at least involving your primary care provider in that conversation, because there may be additional referral pathways that neither of you have thought about, but together you may figure out the best way to go.
Yeah, I remember one of my great mentors said 90% of all the problems with the feet are with the shoes. And so sometimes we can all just look at the shoes and say, I haven't replaced those shoes in 3 years. Laura, what's our very last house call?
Recently, with the newly revised PSA guidelines, I want to start getting a prostate exam. However, I don't want my male physician to do it because I find that humiliating. Is it okay to ask my doctor to refer me to a female doctor to do the exam?
Well, first off, I think it's always okay to ask any question that you really want to ask. I mean, and particularly a difficult, sensitive question like this, I could really understand. And a lot of times, male patients don't want a female provider to do the prostate exam, but we shouldn't make any assumptions about, you know, who that may be. A female patient may not want a male physician to do the gynecology exam, or they may not want a female provider to do the gynecology exam. So I think you should be able to get what you need in a difficult examination to be what you're comfortable with, but maybe have that conversation with the patient first.
Again, conversation with your primary care provider actually will lead in all likelihood to the solution that's most comfortable for you.
Yeah. But assuming you have a good relationship with that provider, that conversation can be had. So, well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can email us any questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host, Dr. Steve Hooper, and our guest today, Maya Dusenberry. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.